part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm here doing part. I'm here doing part-time. I'm here doing part. I'm here doing part-time.
Fanboy.com. How are you, Richard?
I'm good. I just learned that I still have Skype on my computer, which is really exciting.
Well, there you go. Something new to relearn. I love Skype. Been using it for years. This podcast is not sponsored by Skype. Are you a Zoom user? Are you a Zoom head? Is that what you usually default to these days?
No, I'm a Facebook Messenger video call.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I did the Zoom thing. Like, I can't remember why we all started using Zoom a lot.
Me neither.
For some reason.
Yeah.
And I did do those things like back when it was like, before they started cutting you off after 45 minutes.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Skype never did that. Skype is free. Yeah. You can talk for as long as you want. To as many people as you want. And this podcast, again, is not sponsored by Skype. So, Richard Fairgray, thank you for joining me on the Part-Time Fanboy podcast. My name is Christian Horn. We had you back on like a year ago, but you've had several new projects. About a year ago, I think it was, right?
I'm not sure. Yep. I know we did one for Black Sand Beach.
Yep.
One, which is like 3 years ago, and I can't remember. I like
Haunted Hill. You know,
you're very special to me, I promise you that. But
no.
You do a few hundred and
yeah. No, I totally get it. No, January 26, 2022. So about year and a half, something like that. And that was for Haunted Hill, and I had you on for Black Sand Beach.
But right.
I discovered you during Pasadena Comic Con. Like right before I think the pandemic hit with Blastosaurus, you were kind enough to give me a copy of that book, but you have a new project. Is it another Kickstarter coming out, or is it it's with Fanbase Press, correct?
Yes. So this is like the, I mean, when I say that I'm doing hundreds of these things, I mean, this is the year that I have 14 books coming out.
Wow.
So everything is sort of like, Every interview ends up being about six or seven different things.
Sure.
Yes, I do have another Kickstarter that launches August 24th for a book called The Ex-Wives of Frankenstein.
Oh, okay.
It's pre-launch now. Everyone should check it out.
Nice.
But the book, my most recent book to come out is Four Color Heroes from Fanbase Press.
Nice. And I'm sorry, is that out now? I wasn't quite sure. Or is it coming out? Oh, cool.
No, it's out. It launched at Comic-Con.
Oh, okay. That's right. You were at San Diego. Did you have fun at San Diego? How?
It was the best convention of my life.
Oh, like, that's great.
I have realized that I might be physically addicted to the con floor.
Uh-huh.
I did like all 5 days, and I think I slept about an average of 80 or 90 minutes a night each night. And I would be so tired when I got to the floor in the morning.
Yeah.
And I would think like, I've got a signing at 11, and then I will just go back to my Airbnb and I will sleep. And 20 minutes in, I was just like pumped. I was just full of energy, and I'd be there until it closed.
Oh, wow.
And then I would like go and use up all that energy drinking at the Odyssey bar until they kicked me out.
Oh my God. That's funny. Wow. Well, I'm glad you had such a good time. Like that's awesome.
And yeah, it was
so
great.
Four Color Heroes kicked off with Fanbase Press at San Diego Comic Con.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The book is out. Do they just go to Fanbase Press's website? Is it like, where can fans get it?
Fourcolorheroes.com.
Okay.
The number four spelled out FOUR and color spelled the correct way, COLOR. it's a book that is set in New Zealand, but despite that, I would not allow them to put a U in the word color. So it's there. You can find it through the Fanbase Press website. It is on Hoopla and Comic Plus, so if you have a library card, you can read it digitally for free, and you absolutely should. And it will be available as a as an add-on. If you want a signed copy, it'll be there as an add-on on all my Kickstarters moving forward.
Nice. No, I mean, as a fan of your stuff, it is hard to keep up. I mean, I know I've contributed to several of your Kickstarters just because I've become a fan of yours throughout the years, just chatting with you and meeting you at conventions.
Thank you, by the way.
And of course, and reading your stuff. I just pulled out, what was the one? Was it Shed? Is that what it's called? I just pulled it out.
Yep.
Yeah. And I was looking through that yesterday and I was just like, man, this guy's got it. Like, he's got it going on. Like, I very much have enjoyed your stuff through the years. One of the questions that popped up, I mean, I mentioned a little, you know, a couple of seconds ago that I discovered you through Blastosaurus, but it seems like in recent years, a lot of your stories have taken a bit more of like an adult sort of like turn or more mature read, not mature readers, but like, you know, not necessarily Blastosaurus world kind of thing.
Any I mean, like
particular reason?
I started, you know, well, no, I didn't start. I've been doing comics for 31 years at this point.
Yeah.
But like I, for a long time was doing, like before Blastosaurus ever existed, I was doing, you know, introspective weirdo art school comics. I was doing like explorations of what it meant to be a superhero and, you know, the kind of shit that everyone thinks is very clever when they're 20 and assumes that no one else has ever had the same ideas as them.
Sure.
And then Blastosaurus kind of happened, like, you know, I grew up on Ninja Turtles. I love that kind of stuff. And I got this opportunity to, my boyfriend at the time was working on the Wolverine film and the good one, you know, X-Men Origin. and he was like, why don't you just come along? There's some people here who know about your comics. They want to talk to you.
Oh, yes. I remember you telling me about this.
Yeah. And so like Blastosaurus kind of happened because of that. Like I knew I had to put something together and it was like the kind of idea that I'd been playing around with for a long time and never really executed.
Yeah.
And then I just kind of got stuck doing it. And back in 2020, the company that was publishing Blastosaurus, who had at that point owed me thousands and thousands of dollars from like a year earlier and kept coming up with excuses why they couldn't pay me immediately, then used COVID as an excuse to just never pay me.
Oh, wow.
And obviously that sucks. And fuck them. Oh. And
yeah,
all of the other things that go along with that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like it kind of pushed me to just say, well, I'm not doing Blastosaurus anymore. Like I can get that like albatross off my neck and start doing like the kind of comics that I'm like far more interested in.
Oh.
And I had really wanted to spend some time like doing comics where I didn't do any of the stuff I didn't like. So like I don't enjoy coloring. I can color, I just don't enjoy it. Yeah. I don't enjoy digital lettering. I don't like looking at a page that doesn't look finished when I finish drawing it.
Okay.
And so I kind of started doing things like Octopus and Haunted Hill, which were like fully embracing the stuff that I may not be that technically skilled at, but like hand drawing, hand coloring, hand lettering, and kind of finding my own style within it.
Yeah.
And then when, you know, when COVID was like, when everyone else was like, let's make bread, I thought I want to come out of this with like a whole bunch of new stuff and be just ready for the world. When like when conventions come back, I want to be ready for them.
Nice.
And so I approached Fanbase Press because I knew that like they were small, but one, I like them and I trust them. And two, I constantly see them promoting books that they have published, sometimes years after they have published them.
Yeah.
This is a place where like there are so many like mid-range or larger publishers where I have had books that if they blew up day one, they would get a little bit of love from the publisher. If they didn't blow up day one, they would get just forgotten about or sometimes even buried.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone will try something once and then run on to another thing. And Fanbase was like, they looked like a company who would just keep trying to figure it out if one thing didn't work. And frankly, they had good street cred.
Yeah.
So I went to them with 7 pitches and I just said, just choose one. And they chose 4 Color Heroes. And they told me that I could do it in whatever style I wanted. I could do it like Haunted Hill. Barbara, the editor in chief there, she like loves Haunted Hill, so she was very on board for that kind of sloppy, cartoony style.
Yeah.
And I said, "Great, I can have you this book within probably about 3 months." Then I started drawing it, and it just didn't work. Like it felt too simple and too. I don't know, like the style was in conflict with the writing, and it didn't feel grounded. It didn't have a sense of place to it. Haunted Hill, I think, really has a sense of place because it's about Hollywood, and Hollywood is a sloppy, gross place.
Yeah.
yes,
it is.
Yeah, and like, by the way, the best place on Earth, but like still absolutely disgusting. So I wanted, like, this had to feel like 2004 New Zealand, which is when the story is set.
Yeah.
And so I was like, that's a different color palette. That's a different look. There's very specific fabrics on the seats on buses. There's all of these little touchstones that were going to make it feel well observed, I think, because there's nothing I hate more than when you read something or watch something that's set in a time or a place that feels like the writer is viewing it through a telescope.
Yeah.
And so I scrapped the first 14 pages and started over. Adjusted the script so they had like a lot more detail in them, and then went through. And this, by the way, this is the first book I'd done in years where the entire script was done before I started drawing. And then I went and just started drawing it over again, and it became like I think it took 9 months, pretty consistently, 20 hours a day. No days off in that time. Well, no, that's not true. There was a half day off because I had to travel to Montreal because my husband had to get a knee replacement. So while he was in the hospital, I was enjoying a Montreal hotel and coloring.
But oh, that wow.
Half day each way.
Wow. So right. 3 months turned into 9 months is basically.
Yeah.
Well, and fan base press was understanding of that, I'm sure, because they're, like you said, well, they're good people. And yeah.
Well, yeah. And like also, like, you know, this I sold them the idea in 2020 or 2021.
Okay.
Maybe early 21. And then like they were like, this won't come out till 2023. You can have until the end of 2022 to do it.
Oh, got it.
You know, I think like most people who are doing stuff for them have other day jobs and things. And I'm just making comics full time. And frankly, during COVID and with the upheaval from Golden Apple not paying me and the publishers of Black Sand Beach being pretty shitty and skeezy about a lot of stuff, I was just like, fuck it. I can put all of my time into the book that I actually care about right now.
Yeah. Well, the first thing I wanted to say is just interject about fan base press and having done a podcast for as long as I've done it, you know, part-time fanboy, not full-time, but they are one of the first publishers that I've ever seen. Like, you know, I interview a lot of people like, and from a lot of different like small companies and stuff like that. And Fanbase Press, you know, Barbara and Bryant, like they will get on the horn and be like, hey, this interview happened. Like, you know, check out Part-Time Fanboy, check out, you know, Richard Fairgray's interview. Like they are consistently like on the social media, you know, horn, and just, you know, for lack of a better term, my last name being Horn, but they are on the social media horn, you know, out there, you know, doing the thing that they're supposed to be doing as a publisher. Like I can't tell you how many times I've interviewed people from other small publishers, and, you know, I will actually tag the small publisher in the post that I, and they don't retweet it. They don't share it. They don't do any of that. And it's just like, what are you guys doing? Like, what are you guys doing? So Fanbase Press, they know what they're doing. And they are on top of it. And like you said, at least in my experience with them, they have been, you know, very great people. So like,
I want to read you something that I think sums up everything about how great Fanbase Press are. This is the sign off on Barbara's emails.
Oh, yeah.
I sometimes send emails outside of traditional business hours, but do not expect you to do the same.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw that the other day and I was like, wow, well done. So,
I like knowing that, like, if I'm working at 2 a.m. and I hear my phone go, it's probably an email from Barbara. With something
oh, poor Barbara up at 2 a.m. with, yeah. Well, you know, they are hard workers too. No, I mean, this is like, so one of the things I kind of want to go back to, first of all, I think the last time I spoke with you, you had a boyfriend, not a husband. Did you just get married in the last couple of years, or Was that, is that a recent development, or am I misremembering something?
I think you're misremembering. I tell various stories about different boyfriends over the years.
Okay, great. Well, I was going to congratulate you if you had gotten married since the
time.
Well,
look, it's a good marriage. You can keep congratulating me on it.
Good.
Well, he's a wonderful man.
Great. Well, congratulations on that. But like, I want to kind of go back to like the, you know, you mentioned like Blastosaurus, like sort of being an albatross a little bit, and you going like more diving into the sort of things that you wanted to do with comics, right? Mm-hmm. Like, because I think that like I interview a lot of people, and also speaking for myself throughout the years, like making comics, I feel like there's a lot of people making comics to make the comics that they feel that they have to do instead of what they want to do, what they feel like will be successful, what they feel like will work, as opposed to like the things that they really, really like enjoy or dive into. Can you talk to me about that sort of like psychological shift that happened with you? And also just like how you saw Blastosaurus as being an albatross? Because like, was it that you just didn't want to do kids comics? Were you doing, or was it that, you know, the publisher wasn't paying you? Like, why did you see Blastosaurus as an albatross?
I want to defend Blastosaurus a little bit, because he's one of my very close personal friends.
sure.
Him and Crash Bandicoot, number one and number two. But firstly, I think it's always really obvious when someone's doing the thing you said, like when someone is making the comic that they think they should make rather than the one that they really care about.
Yeah.
I think there are thousands of comics that I couldn't tell apart, from basic concept to theme to tone. Like, you see it all the time. It's comics that have the flavor of other comics. And they might be perfectly serviceable. Like, we all need a lot of comics to read, but we probably won't remember them. And I'm not really, I'm 38. I'm not that interested in making comics that people won't remember.
Yeah.
Blastosaurus is like, I hate it when people say something is a love letter to something else, but 22-year-old me was certainly thinking of it as like what would I do with Ninja Turtles? Because sure. Like, I've loved the Ninja Turtles since I was 3 years old. The first thing I ever stole was a pack of Ninja Turtles trading cards, mostly because I wanted to try gum. I'd never had gum before.
Oh, really?
And the first card in the pack was this picture of Raphael wearing the fedora and the trench coat, and it says, "Here's looking at you, kid." And I remember seeing that and just thinking, like, I have no idea what this is, but that man is wearing a hat and thinks that it's a good disguise when he has a green face. That is very funny.
Nice.
Like, looking at it now, I'm like, yeah, I guess a lot of kids are really into good bogey references. But it was such a weird card. Like, and I've kept that card ever since. It's still in my wallet to this day.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
But this show just, like, it spoke to me on some much deeper level, because it did things that no other TV show was doing at the time. And it still bothered me as a kid that these turtles, like, they were always operating between two different tones of like genuine action adventure and very like loose meta commentary on like the merchandising of their own world. And it was like they were kind of like never quite picking a lane. And looking back at those early episodes now, they're quite ridiculous. And it's always because the cool, serious stuff doesn't get to come through. You start seeing it more in like the 2003 series or the 2012 series, where it starts working better.
Yeah.
It starts finding its own like voice, I guess. And obviously the comics always had a voice. I'm talking about like the limitations of what kids TV could do.
Yeah.
Cause I didn't actually read a Turtles comic till I was, I think, in my 20s. It was always the show for me and the toys.
Nice. Okay.
And, you know, I'd wanted to create like some version of this. I've had a stuffed dinosaur that I've cuddled every night since I was 7 years old.
Yeah.
It's a Triceratops, so obviously that's by default my favorite dinosaur, even though I really don't give a shit about dinosaurs. And I was like, well, if I had this, like, do I want Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, or do I want my real fantasy of getting to hang out with Master Splinter? When I was a kid, I bought all four turtles and a Master Splinter toy. Then I put the turtles in a wheelbarrow and put them on the other side of the yard. And then I sat in my treehouse and like had conversations with Master Splinter and would like practice kissing him.
That's awesome.
Like super healthy, normal behavior. he did have a removable kimono. I think that that spoke to me. Yeah. But
not anatomically, you know, correct, I'm assuming. Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of fur. Who knows what's going on?
Jeez. I just saw the new Turtles movie literally yesterday, and I was never a huge... I never fell into the Turtles, like, you know, wheelbarrow or whatever, or drank the Turtles Kool-Aid. I wasn't exposed that much to it, but I will say that I loved it. Like, I loved the movie. I wanted to see it because it looked visually interesting, and I was just like, yeah, I loved it. And so, yeah, I can totally get why you enjoyed the Turtles.
I by default love it because I think it has a lot of good stuff in the second half. I think the first half is very sweaty. It's doing a lot of heavy lifting to try and get you to care about these characters and not really pulling it off, I think, until the scene where April pukes everywhere.
Yeah.
I think it's the fifth best of the 9 Turtles movies that I've seen. And I am including the fan-made one because that one is definitely number one.
There's a fan-made one? I did not know about this.
Oh, look this up. It's fucking phenomenal. There is a fan-made film that Nickelodeon actually bought and released on DVD called Turtles Forever.
Okay.
And it's the 2003 Turtles... the animated series, and they get like caught on camera. Splinter is angry with them. Then when you see the footage on the news, it is the 87 Turtles eating pizza on a rooftop.
Really?
And basically the dimensions are crossing over. It's everything that Spider-Verse does like years and years earlier.
Really?
And it's like the Shredder from the 2003 version teams up with Krang. And they like fix the Technodrome so that it can travel across all the dimensions. And their goal being to go to Turtles Prime and go into the comic and kill the original Turtles so that none of the Turtles will ever exist across any version.
Uh-huh.
Oh. It's really cool.
Interesting. Well, let's stop talking about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, though, Richard. Let's talk about book.
Let me wheel it back to like why it's about Blastosaurus.
Okay, yeah.
Like, so I made this comic that was a grumpy old man who wished he wasn't shaped like a dinosaur. Okay. So I got to play in this action-adventure comedy space while still having it be entirely for me.
Yeah.
And I found an audience through that because, like, Blastosaurus on the surface can very much seem like a lazy parody or that kind of comic you're talking about where people are like, well, this dinosaur likes to punch things. That's two things that sell well.
Yeah.
You know, it's like my new series, Laser Tits. Like, these things will work. But,
yeah,
people who read the comic realized that it was far more than that. And then I kept coming up against this problem that people who didn't already know the comic assumed that it was the lazy bullshit thing. So I had to start releasing these, like, weird side things about Blastosaurus, like, struggling to be a person and not knowing how to water plants that well or not being able to find friends to play with his model trains or eating too much ham and feeling bad about himself.
Uh-huh.
And it really was a comic that I truly loved, and I was making a decent amount of money from it back in New Zealand and able to kind of just do Blastosaurus. And then when I moved to the U.S., Golden Apple made the offer to pay me to make new Blastosaurus. But it was very clear that it had to be the straight down the line, like, you can do your weird side stuff if you want, but you still have to have an action adventure thing at the core of it.
Yeah.
And I really like some of the stuff that Paul and I wrote for that, but it certainly felt like I came to America to do something different, and I took on that deal out of fear.
Yeah.
Because America's a scary place to, you know, show up broke.
Sure.
And
yeah, California is too. Yeah.
And then like after, like there's just so many stories in my life of company shows up, says, hey, we're brand new and we have a big pile of money. We want to spend it on your dinosaur. We promise we'll do everything well. Yeah. Cut to 2 years later, they fucked me over completely. Like Golden Apple owes me money, but like American Original owes me significantly more money. That's never going to happen. They don't exist. It's just a thing that kept happening, and it kind of felt like after 14 years of Blastosaurus, I really just wanted to, I don't want to be the person who like, I don't want my tombstone to say he drew Blastosaurus.
Gotcha. Well, let's talk about Four Color Heroes. Like, I mean, what is it about? Like, what is it? what I have not read it or been exposed to it. So I need to imagine, go to Fanbase Press and check it out. But
imagine if right now I said, well, it's about a crime fighting dinosaur.
That would be awesome. That would be just like the greatest thing. Or if you said like, it's about crime fighting turtles, that would just be like the best thing ever. That would be like, wow, we just went there. No, but what is it? So, I mean, Four Color Heroes to me, like, speaks of like comic books, right? Like, or superheroes or that sort of thing. But I've seen the cover. I've seen some of the art because, I mean, I follow you on, we're friends on Facebook and, you know, Instagram and all that sort of thing. So I've seen some of the stuff, but it doesn't look like, it looks more like a coming of age sort of thing. What is Four Color Heroes?
Well, it's a mix of both.
Okay.
So it's two boys who fall in love through comic books.
Okay.
It's two 15-year-old boys. One of them has been homeschooled his entire life from a very religious background. And the other one is a kind of traditional bad kid, like a real little stinker.
Yeah.
And their names are Oscar and Patrick. And Oscar is now having to go to a regular school for the first time. His mother has told him to just stay in a classroom during the lunch break because, you know, you don't know which kids are going to be a bad influence on you.
Uh-huh.
Of course, that just means that he's in the same room as Patrick, who's in there on detention because he told Mrs. Waldron to eat a shit. And Patrick is in there, like, full of energy and, like, just excited to meet a new person. And Oscar is very nervous and shy. But Patrick is reading this comic book, and Oscar cannot stop looking at it. He knows he shouldn't, but he just can't, like, tear his eyes away from it. And obviously, Patrick kind of weaponizes this and makes fun of him for it, but is kind of so fascinated by this weird little alien boy who's shown up in his world that he says to him, I have a solution. You don't have to look at it if I describe it to you.
Mm.
And so throughout the book, you never actually see the real comic books. You just see them how Oscar imagines them. And as their lives pull them further and further apart, every month they have this reason to find a safe, hidden, secret place together to talk about the new issue of this superhero book that's coming out. And obviously Oscar's understanding grows and like the comic that he imagines becomes more like a real comic. But like it's essentially what I've managed to do is tell seven complete superhero stories as they would be if an excited 15-year-old fan retold them to you, because I honestly think most of the time that's a far better way to experience comics. Like, it's way better when your friend tells you about a comic than actually reading it yourself.
Oh, okay. Okay. I don't know that I would necessarily always agree with that, but I totally get the sentiment.
Always. There are many good comics, but you know what I mean? When someone, if you don't care about something or you don't know about something and the person who does is so genuinely thrilled by it that you're just caught up in their enthusiasm.
Yeah. Or get put off. Sometimes I get like really excited about something and I'm like talking about, people are like, wow, you're like super, like, what is the deal? You're freaking me out. So yeah, I tend to be that type of person that if I really love something, I really love it. And if I really dislike something, I really dislike it. Although as I'm getting older, there tends to be an in between. But your idea sounds like wonderful and like really genuine and not anything that I've like really heard about before. Is this kind of pulled from your personal experience a bit, or like, how did you, I mean, obviously stupid writer question, you know, that I always have to ask, but how did you come up with this idea? You know what I mean? Like, where did it spring from?
Well, I've had the idea for about 10 years. I'm always interested in the idea of like, where do we find community? Where do we find our people? And I think that a comic book store is a natural place for that for a lot of people.
Sure.
I think the way, like, I can't remember if this is something that someone else said that was being repeated to me, but my friend David always says that, like, human beings are the story-making animals. Mm. Like, that is what defines us. And so, like, bonding over storytelling, I think, is so important. And it doesn't always have to be comics or books. It can just be jokes, or it can be remembering a movie or doing an impression of a comedian. Like, it's the way we talk to each other when we're kids. And it was around the time that the Westboro Baptist Church were really kind of at the peak of their popularity, shall we say. And I had thought, like, what does it look like when a person is from that world and coming into the real world? And, like, how can I use comics to tell that story? I kind of abandoned a lot of it because, like, one, I realized I didn't want to make it about a very famous evil church. I wanted to make it about the much smaller but just as toxic on a personal level, churches that exist everywhere.
Yeah.
And I didn't want it to just be an angry book about how religion's dumb. I wanted it to be a book about how all forms of like weirdly oppressive masculine ideals are dumb.
Yeah.
So while it is like, while we are seeing Oscar's very like oppressive journey through, you know, through that and through Mark, and then in the story, it's set in 2004 in New Zealand, which is when the debate was going on over the civil union bill, which was a sort of precursor to gay marriage.
Yeah.
And so I was 19 when that was going on, and I remember very clearly all the marches that were happening and all the discussions around, like, well, you know, should we give people rights? I mean, so it seems like a lot of people don't want us to. Maybe we should compromise. And the feeling of that is pretty awful. But it's, you know, you learn all of these ways that, like, even if you're in the most accepting friend group or family, you still find these ways to, like, there are still limits where, I mean, even today, like, I have to pretty regularly make the choice of, like, do I want to have this fight with my friend when they post online about eating Chick-fil-A? Or do I want to make the concession because I like having them as my friend because of other good qualities they have despite that one shitty thing?
No. Just like the basic concept of like being given rights, or that rights are earned, or rights can be granted. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like we are, and it's like the Constitution says we're born, you know, with unalienable rights. You know what I'm saying? Like everyone.
Yeah. The constant math you have to do if you're in any kind of minority, you're always having to do that math in real time of how much can I push right now? How much can I expect from people? How much better can the situation be? Or how safe is it for me to ask the question?
Yeah.
And I really wanted to explore that. Patrick's, there's a very easy way for me to have written Patrick as a straight character who discovers he's gay. And I wasn't, I think there are plenty of stories about that already. I wanted to do a story about the people that I saw in my high school who were so obviously gay and were allowed to be as long as they never said it out loud.
Oh, wow.
Like the kind of, there's always that one kid who's referred to as like, oh, well, which Robert? Oh, gay Robert. Okay, we know which one that is. Uh-huh. He's sort of effeminate and makes a lot of big gestures. And we can accept him doing that. But if he ever actually started dating a boy, we couldn't be friends with him anymore.
Yeah.
Like, they can be your gay friend as long as they're not actively gay. Which, you know, is still, again, I'm 38 years old. I have had times in my life in this decade where I have, in the decade of my 30s, not the decade of the 2020s, where like I have been living with people who it was always an unspoken rule that they could bring home any girl and, you know, fuck her in any room of the house. But if I ever brought a man home, it would be, please just do that in your room because, why would you rub that in our faces?
So, I mean, speaking from that experience, how did you go about crafting your two main protagonists in this book? Like what, because again, I have not read it, so I don't know how we're coming from, you know, each angle, like how they meet, how their discovery happens, how their, you know, for just a corny term, like love blossoms or whatever, however you want to put it. How did you sort of approach that? Because I mean, whenever we've spoken, you know, met in person once, maybe once or twice, and spoken on the podcast, you've always been open and honest, like literally about everything. And there's a certain courage in that, right? Like that I admire. Like, I'm like, this guy just says it as it is, which is part of the reason why I love having you on and just love talking to you, because I mean, you're open and you're honest. And I tend to be that kind of person too, at least open and honest. I wouldn't say courageous, but you know, I say what's on my mind for the most part. Gets me into trouble sometimes. But in any case, how, you know, and you approach your work very directly and you're very honest about like why you want to do something or why you think something is good and why you think something is bad. How did you, because you work on so many different comics for this particular book, like was there a different way that you crafted your main characters speaking to that experience?
Yeah. So within the original idea, I was going to focus most of my attention on Oscar, the one from the religious background.
Gotcha.
And I realized as I started writing the script that there really wasn't a way for me to write this which wouldn't feel like a 15-year-old who's just discovered atheism. You know, like that kind of that sure. aggressive, I'm gonna pull the rug out from under these suckers approach. And so I switched, I sort of made Patrick the main protagonist of the story because it gave me a way, where I could think, how would I have reacted to someone like this when I was that age? Mm. And then how can I add 20% more kindness because Patrick is, I think, more empathetic than I was at that age, but also he's in a much worse situation than I was in, and is able to, like, he's looking for some safety.
Yeah.
And then with every scene, because there's almost no scenes in the story where the two of them aren't together.
Oh, okay.
Because it's seven chapters set across seven issues of the comic coming out. And so there are these gaps between where like other stuff has happened and they have like they still need reasons to come together, but like they won't have seen each other for weeks at a time. So any of that like natural growth that would happen as they think about their own feelings towards each other is happening off screen.
Okay.
And I think that like I had just a kind of a schedule laid out of what does Oscar know about himself at each point. And so I could always write each thing with like with those rules in mind. The word gay is said I think once in the entire book, and it's in a Patrick's older brother jumps in front of the anti-civil union march, and to make fun of all these religious people marching. And screams that he can feel the Lord coming through him and that Jesus is making him gay. This complicated approach where he's not like his older brother is a villainous character. Like he's a chaotic and sometimes evil force in their lives, but he's still Patrick's brother. So he's never going anywhere. And he's sometimes kind because he's gone through this shit as well. But he is not the same bad force as the religious people marching against gay rights.
Yeah.
He is a different thing that is also against them. He is the one who's out there making fun of everything and being toxic and shitty to everyone.
Yeah.
But Oscar, like he says from the beginning, he doesn't know if he believes in God. He knows that he believes in being good and doing the right thing, and he's never questioned what that looks like before because he's just followed the rules. At the point where they kiss in the story, it was really important for me that this was the first moment that Oscar had ever thought about sexuality in any form. He hadn't tried to deny being gay because it had never occurred to him that it was even a possibility, but he'd also never considered being straight, you know?
Interesting.
And so at that point, there's enough trust between the two of them that even though the kiss leads to like a pretty big fight between the two of them and one of them kicking over some paint and running away, it's still very much, the reaction to it doesn't have to be like, oh no, you kissed me. What are you, gay or something?
Yeah.
It can just be a very like, that is a thing that happened. I don't know how I feel about it.
Yeah.
What if it was a good thing? What if I'm happy that it happened? Meanwhile, Patrick is seeing Oscar as this like weird creature who's come into his life, who's shown up at his school, who is unlike anyone he's ever met. And even though he hates so much about him, or so much about where he's from, he doesn't want to corrupt and ruin him. And he knows that he is the younger brother of the bad kid. He's the one with the drunk, abusive dad. He's the one that the police are at his house. He's the one that is known at the school. You know, he says in the first chapter, like, once you're in detention, once you're just going to kind of keep being there. If you are labeled as this thing, it's what you will be. And he thinks that he deserves it. He thinks he is born to be another bad kid because his brother was.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want to rub off on Oscar and turn him into that.
Yeah.
So there's like, I'm trying to always write their friendship as having like five or six different tensions.
Gotcha.
And so because they only have this one time to come together each month, they have to address all of that and then stop themselves so they can talk about comics instead and find safety in a different story that, spoiler, may or may not reflect real life a lot more than the comics.
Yeah. You know what? Like, the more you talk about this story, the more I really, 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 really want to check it out. Because I don't... there are not a lot of... It seems like what you're touching on, right, is discovery through adolescence, through comics or friendship or whatever, romance or coming out and, like, you know, whatever it is. And I don't know that this is something that has really, I remember there was a book called Teenagers from Mars, and that was like a really good comic that dealt with like kids who liked comics and, you know, but it's been so long since I read it. But this to me seems like it's gonna be the sort of thing that like recently I had a friend from high school pass away and, you know, I posted about it on Facebook and stuff like that. It was somebody that I hadn't been in touch with on a regular basis for a long time. But during my high school years was very much like the person that you shared comics book, the person that you shared role-playing mm-hmm. games with, you know, the person that I drew in front of and like, here's your character and here's this character. And it seems like what you're touching on is very much that phase in life, particularly for nerds, right? Where mm-hmm. you start to, sorry, I'm having trouble like walking through it because you kind of blew my mind where I'm realizing, and I've probably had this realization before, but maybe it's just because we're discussing it, that like comics come at such an important developmental time, and the time that you share it with your friends who are also into it is so important. And there's such growth that happens during it that it seems to me like what you're talking about is just like a real important time in adolescence and how important comics can be to that. Am I close or have I just shot off the rails or?
No, I think you're right. Like, I think that, one thing I really like about the medium of comics is yeah. that, like, we are now at a point where kids can talk to their grandparents about Superman, and their yeah. grandparents know who Superman is because they read him growing up.
Yeah.
And it's a different Superman now, and they can have different opinions because that's what being young is, but, like, they still have this thing that connects them across that time.
Yeah.
And they are our modern mythology in a way that TV and film aren't, because, like, drawing hasn't changed that much. I mean, yes, the style of comics has changed pretty drastically over the past 80, 90 years, but not in a way that's unrecognizable and not in a way where, like, golden age comic style is still being done by a lot of people. Everything mm-hmm. is now available. No one's making films like they did in the 1920s.
Yeah.
No one wants to make something that looks like Buster Keaton. You are instead getting, like, the newest, best version of whatever, and everyone kind of goes to see it because it's a film. But comics, like, bridge this gap in a really exciting way for me. And comics are something that I think all that, like, I don't think everyone will like comics, but I think that if you pick up a comic and you enjoy the method of storytelling, then you're just kind of in.
Yeah.
You know, it's why I get really annoyed when people are like, what's the first comic a person should read? I'm like, well,
yeah.
I don't know. probably Spawn 38 that they find for a dollar in a thrift store.
Like, jeez. Not Spawn 38, Richard. Come on, Rich. Don't go to Spawn. Anyway, go ahead. Go ahead.
No. Well, I mean, I say Spawn
38. I know what you're saying.
It is the first comic that I read.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Oh,
I just picked
okay.
it up at a used bookstore for $2, and I read it like 11 times, being like, I have no fucking clue what's going on.
Yeah.
Like, this is pretty, I guess.
Yeah.
I think I hate it, but I really like reading it.
Yeah.
And like, I think most people, the first comic they read is something like that, where they find, like, this is why I don't believe in new issue ones all the time. I don't believe in reading things. I think your new readers, if they're going to like comics, will pick up the book and figure it out.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Not only that, but if they pick it up in the middle of a story and they're like, what the hell is happening? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, they're just like, what's going on? And it becomes kind of like a mystery to the reader, right? It's like, who's this Wolverine guy? Like, what's he doing? Wait, things pop out of his, and then who's this Storm chick? Like, she can, you know, pardon my use of the word chick, you know, but you know, you understand what I'm saying? Like for me, it was kind of like X-Men, or actually Captain Carrot and his Amazing Zoo Crew was my first comic, but it was very much like, what are these animals doing? Like, you know, who are they? And like, you know, and it becomes kind of like part of the fun of it, right?
Mm. Because I think the truth is, with monthly comics, every single book is a slice of life book. I know that slice of life is its own whole genre now, and it's a genre that I do quite a lot of, but most superhero books are also secretly slice of life, and that's why they're so exciting, is because they can actually work in those slices.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, no, I mean, well, that's the debate I've had with a lot of people, you know, who have kind of disparaged some of the TV shows where they're like, oh, the romance and stuff like that. And I'm like, dude, have you ever read an issue of Amazing Spider-Man? Like, what are you talking about? He's like fretting about Gwen Stacy or Mary Jane. Like, that's all it is. It is literally a soap opera. So why do you have a problem with the romance on the do you love me, do you not love me on the TV shows or whatever? It's like, get over it. You know, I mean, whatever.
Well, I would make the argument that a TV show that I have to sit through an hour of each week to, you know, to follow is very different than a monthly thing that takes 5 to 7 minutes to read.
Sure.
I think, like, I'm not opposed to the romance in these things. I am opposed to the melodrama instead of good storytelling. And look, I'm at the beginning of 2020, I'm a little bitter about superhero TV shows, because in 2020, I was going to do so many conventions because Black Sand Beach was coming out. And I was going to do a tour. And like, I wanted to, for the first time in my life, be able to talk about like geek culture without being out of touch. So I was like, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to watch the entire Arrowverse. I'm going to watch all of it. Uh-huh. I'm going to know everything, because like, it's all right there for me and I can just do this.
Yeah.
And I got through most of The Flash, Arrow, Supergirl, Legion of Superheroes, Black Lightning, I can't even think, everything. I was 2 episodes into the big Crisis crossover, and then lockdown started, and I was like, I don't need to watch any more of this ever.
Jeez. So you were watching it for an intended purpose, and then purpose,
I was like,
you were not interested anymore.
While I drew.
Oh no, that's funny. So one of the things I wanted to ask you, I mean, we were talking about Blastosaurus and kind of the shift that you've made. Has it been difficult making that shift? Has it been difficult changing from doing what is essentially an all ages kind of book to the sort of things that you're doing now? And has your fan base followed you like along that path? Because I mean, you know, I'm also a subscriber to your newsletter, you know, and I see them come through every once in a while. And, you know, like you have been in these interviews, you talk
Thank
about-
Thank you for that very subtle shade about how my newsletter has stopped being as regular as I promised it would be.
I did not say that. I said that I am a subscriber to your newsletter, letting people know that you have a newsletter and they should subscribe to it.
And that was more
a thing of me not being able to read everything that comes into my inbox. So I apologize about that. But no, for me, it's like, because you're very outspoken about, you know, sexuality and things like that, and your language can sometimes be like very adult and stuff like that. Has there been a shift in your fan base, and has it been hard to shift to tell the kind of stories that, like you said, you want to tell?
It's been easier than I thought it would be.
Nice. Good.
There's still a little bit of fear every now and again that, like, what am I doing? Shouldn't I be pursuing? Like, everyone keeps telling me the only money is in all ages content, blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
And I think that I'm in a lucky position where I made a big pile of money from comics before COVID, and I've been able to pursue things that are less financially viable with the hope that they will pick up.
Yeah.
And they seem to be, honestly. Like, now that conventions are back, I tend to do pretty well at those. And I've run two Kickstarters so far that have both, not gone crazy or anything, but for a first and second campaign for books where I don't have to pay an artist,
Yeah.
like, I can make a pretty comfortable amount of money for the amount of time it takes to put together the books. And I think that is going to work. At the same time as all of this, of course, like, Black Sand Beach is now being turned into a TV show, so that publisher is coming
Oh.
back trying to get me to do more stuff, and there's a lot of pressure from them. But, like, fuck them. They have not treated me well. I'm not interested and like, on a personal level, like, I am so much happier now than I was back then. I would be when I was putting out Haunted Hill, first, when it was just as a web comic, and I was doing a lot of these interviews for it, and volume one of Cardboardia had also come out, and I was doing interviews for that as well, and some stuff for Black Sand Beach, and some stuff for another thing, and it was kind of getting a little overwhelming, and I'd ask before any interview started, which book is this for? Just to double check. Because if I'm talking about Haunted Hill, I'm gonna say some adult things. If I'm talking about an all ages book, I'm not going to. Like, I'm
Yeah.
as much like I'm very open and unfiltered, but I have no interest in, like, saying something to shock. You know what I mean?
Sure,
So I
absolutely.
was always very careful with this, and I was always worried. I would come away from every interview being like, "Oh shit, did I overshare? Did I say something that was too much?" I'm pretty open about the fact that I stole a lot of stuff when I was a kid. I robbed banks to fund my first movie. I blackmailed my librarian to get my first comic published. Like, there's a lot of things that I think are completely fine because they're kind of like Bart Simpson-esque activities that kids would, find fun.
Yeah.
But I'm always terrified that I might have said too much. Or especially with Black Sand Beach, where it's a book that is, I mean, it's a horror story about a boy who can't remember what happened to him last summer at his family beach house. Like, there's some subtext there, guys. And I
Yeah.
think it's important to talk about that subtext because for other kids who read that and see what's going on and feel seen and feel understood by a story, it really matters that I'm confirming it.
Yeah.
It doesn't change the story for other people who haven't had things like that happen to them, who just read it and go, okay, cool.
Yeah.
They can still get a good, fun horror story out of it. But I would always worry that I'd said something that was going to get me in trouble. I don't like getting in trouble,
Sure.
I've always been like the broken weirdo, right? I have learned very much like that I never understand the world the way other people do, and there's no worse feeling to me than people turn around saying, "Richard, why did you say that?" Or, "Richard, why do you think like that?" Which was
Oh, I've
most of my
gotten that
childhood.
too.
And so anyway, I was doing all these interviews, and I hadn't asked. And right before the interview started, the interviewer said, "Oh, by the way, before we start, I actually read Haunted Hill. I fucking love it." I was like, "Oh, cool. That tells me we're talking about Haunted Hill today, because why would an interviewer have read something unless it was directly sent to them to, like, prepare for the interview?"
Well, because they like your
Anyway,
stuff,
so
maybe.
sure. So first question comes up, and he says, "So Richard, a lot of this story is set in real places. Can you tell us, like, a little bit which one is your favorite?" And I said, "Oh, definitely Slamtown, where Eva works. It's based on Slammer, my favorite sex club in LA."
Oh.
And he sort of stared at me, and then I described some of the features of Slammer in great detail that I
Oh
have
no.
accurately represented in the book. The term "the floor there gets pretty gushy" might have
Oh
been
no.
bandied about. And then he said, "Okay, but we are here to talk about Cardboardia, which also has some stuff set in a very real New York City." And I went, "Fuck Oops. You know, like, what can I do? Like, the worst possible version of... Fortunately, I wasn't... It was live. Fortunately, it wasn't to kids. It was all to librarians.
Good. Okay, gotcha.
You know, but... And also, fuck Carbordia. I don't care if that book gets read by anyone ever.
Oh, no.
But it was still very much like, the worst thing has happened, and I'm fine. I'm still alive. I'm still well, and I can still make comics tomorrow.
Yeah.
It was a huge relief.
Oh my goodness, that's so funny. So you have a Kickstarter coming up, right? I mean, we talked about Four Color Heroes, which fanbasepress.com, right?
And yep.
I got you.
Or
got
fourcolorheroes.com.
Yeah, fourcolorheroes.com. That's great. Before we wrap up, I mean, what Kickstarter launches soon, correct? That's what you had said earlier?
So August 24th is issue one of The Ex-Wives of Frankenstein.
Yes.
It is my new series about Elizabeth Frankenstein and the Bride of Frankenstein on the day that they find out that their husbands, in fact, are alive and have been living as a gay couple in the Arctic Circle
and are
returning to the city as heroes of the MRA movement and Twitter.
That is awesome.
And so it's about like the complicated nature of a friendship where you are pitted against each other because of who you are, but you are you're the only two people in the world who will understand what you're going through. And so you are finding that, like, finding every reason you can to spend time together and push past all of those things that would make it hard to do.
This sounds like another great one. I will be contributing to that when that launches. That's great. Well, Richard, where can people find you online just in general? Like, are you on X or Twitter or whatever the hell?
I will be on Twitter until the day I die.
Really? You won't give it up. Okay.
The reason I won't is because of spaces. The Twitter spaces are really important. I don't think you should ever give up on something that you've carved out for yourself.
Uh-huh.
I think that there are a lot of really bad people in the world who will try and turn good places into bad ones. And I think it is our responsibility to hold our ground. I don't think it makes a difference if advertising money from me being on Twitter goes to Elon Musk or not.
I would disagree, but anyway, go on.
Well, I think from me as one person, I think like the amount that is to him is so much less important than like me being a person on a platform where I can talk directly to people. Like, I will never pay for Twitter.
Yeah.
But I will shit in his backyard for free.
Gotcha.
I will criticize him in his house for free.
Gotcha.
And I think that if we as the good people on the right side of things keep running away to find new places to be and giving up that ground, I think we end up getting completely boxed out of conversations. And I think especially with spaces on Twitter where you get to talk out loud to people in an unrecorded but free form way where anyone can listen, has been really invaluable to me in a way that like no form of chat has ever managed to do and no form of video conferencing has ever managed to do. So I will be on Twitter. I'm Richard Fairgray on Twitter. I'm Richard Fairgray author on Instagram. By the way, if Blue Sky gets an equivalent of spaces, or if, you know, Clubhouse doesn't collapse and becomes available to Android users, then like those become equivalent options. But like, I think the talking out loud is so valuable. Hearing the intonation in someone's voice, that like the nuance that is lost through a 280 character tweet all comes back when you can hear someone's tone as they ask you a question or make a comment.
Got it. So it provides you one aspect of a service that you really love. So gotcha. Yeah. I could get into a discussion about it, but I won't. If you find value in it, then that's great. But Instagram, you're on Instagram. You're also on Facebook too.
I want to ask, like, I'm not, I say I will be on there till the day I die. I was more making the comment of, I will call it Twitter till the day I die.
Gotcha. It's not Professor X's school.
I'm open to being told I'm wrong. I'm open to someone convincing me otherwise. But at this point, I don't like when the choice is either be on a shitty platform run by a shitty person or be nowhere, I know that like I make enough concessions in my life, I'm not going to be silenced by the existence of someone bad.
I think that there are other options, maybe not as good or far-reaching, and I feel that when the shitty person owns the platform, there's definitely, you know, considerations to take. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah,
not saying that Mark Zuckerberg is not a shitty person either. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? But there, I think at this point, we all have to deal with degrees of shittiness.
Yeah.
Like, exactly. You know what I'm saying? And I would rather, you know, it's like we talked about Chick-fil-A earlier. It's like, I don't need a Chick-fil-A. Never have, never will. You know what I'm saying? Just won't do it. But, you know, does that mean like, I don't eat Kentucky Fried Chicken either, but I'm just saying like Kentucky Fried Chicken, are they a perfect company? Probably not. It's the same thing with like,
there's a,
you know,
there's a difference between a perfect company and Chick-fil-A. Like those are obviously you can see how those are different.
Yes.
But also like, if like, here's a life hack. If you want the Chick-fil-A experience at home, you can just donate directly to online hate groups.
Gotcha. Yes, yes. I don't disagree with that at all. I don't disagree with that at all. Okay, so Richard Fairgray on, what is it on Instagram?
On Instagram, it's Richard Fairgray author. RichardFairgray.com if you want to read about 2,500 pages of free content.
Yes.
And again, Four Color Heroes is on Hoopla and Comics Plus. So if you have a library card, you can read it for free on their digital platforms.
Yes. And fanbasepress.com as well.
Yes.
We should mention them. And your Kickstarter is called once again,
The Ex-Wives of Frankenstein.
Coming August
24th.
24th. Awesome. Yes. Richard Fairgray, thank you so much for joining me. I've always considered you and still consider you one of the most actually interesting people in comics and quite talented as well. I love your stories. I love being able to help out in any way possible. So thank you for joining me. I just really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. You gave me a reason to stop drawing pictures for an hour.
Well, keep after this, get back to drawing.
I will. There's again, a heat wave and I have to work under lamps. I'm in a nightmare zone.
Oh no. Is the AC not working or just not central air?
Oh, I'm in Canada at the moment.
Oh, okay.
So they're like, we don't believe in air conditioning up here because it's meant to always be temperate, but it's 84 degrees with no AC.
Yeah, that's not good. That's not good. Well, either way, Richard Fairgray, please check out his work. Please check out Four Color Heroes. Please check out The Ex-Wives of Frankenstein on Kickstarter coming soon. Richard, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate you taking the time. My name is Christian Horn. This has been another episode of the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. You can check us out on our website, parttimefanboy.com. We are still on Facebook. We are still on Instagram. We are not on Twitter. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Thanks for listening. Please go check out Richard Fairgray's work. It is excellent. I highly, highly, highly recommend it. He is a wonderful person and an interesting creator. And I love what he calls his sloppy art. I think it's well done. So thank you very much. And we will be back soon with another episode. Bye. Part-time fanboy.